Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Before we get started today, I have a favor to ask our listeners. Caroline is turning 85 on June 8th, 2020. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that Caroline loves sending and receiving mail. So we would like to ask you to send a birthday card. We're making it a surprise, so send it to Caroline Kilborn, care of Monica Hadley, P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. That's P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. Thank you, and now on with the show. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline Kilborn, is off this week, but she will be back with us next time. And we do have a very timely topic to talk about today on Writer's Voices, as you will see as we get into it. Our guest today is Deborah Wiles. She is the author of the picture book Freedom Summer and the novels Love Ruby Lavender, The Aurora County All-Stars, and Each Little Bird That Sings, a National Book Award finalist, and A Long Line of Cakes. She is also the author of the documentary novels Countdown and Revolution, another National Book Award finalist, and Anthem. She has vivid memories of ducking and covering under her school desk during air raid drills at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Deborah lives in Atlanta, Georgia. You can visit her on the web at deborahwiles.com, and that's D-E-B-O-R-A-H. W-I-L-E-S.com, and she's also on Twitter and Pinterest and Instagram. And the book that we're talking about today is Kent State, which is a book for middle grade readers, I believe. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Deborah.
Thank you. I think it's, I would say because of some of the material in the book and the language, it's probably YA, young adult, like
Okay. Probably
high school and crossover into adult, probably. So okay. I'd say 14 and up.
All right.
Right out front for listeners. But thank you. Thank you for having me. This is really going to be great. I don't often get to talk about writing and the writing process. I really am talking more about the story, which I know is important too. But
yes, obviously.
The process is really a huge part of the story.
Well, tell us how you became so interested and involved in Kent State. And actually, some listeners might not know what is important about Kent State, what happened there. I think anyone our age will remember, but I'm not sure if people born 20, 30 years later necessarily have that same that same attachment to what happened there.
Right, and the context is important not only for back then but for now. We have just passed the 50-year anniversary of May 4th, 1970, which was the day that the Ohio National Guard on the Kent State campus was trying to quell and contain a Vietnam War protest, and ended up over a three-day escalation that by May 4th, things had reached such a crucial cross point that the National Guard ended up firing their rifles into a crowd, a huge crowd of unarmed college students, many of them teenagers, killing four of them, wounding nine more, and effectively ending the 60s and beginning the end of the Vietnam War, because America was stunned. I was 16. It was actually 3 days before my 17th birthday. I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, where my dad, who was an Air Force pilot, was stationed. So we lived there for 2 years, from 68 to 70. And during that time, my dad flew so many missions to Vietnam, carrying supplies and bringing home bodies. And we knew, we three kids knew, that we just didn't talk about the war at the dinner table when he was even there. It was difficult for everybody. I had no real political opinions formed before this moment. I grew up in a military family and a Southern family. And for me, it was very much, you know, you learn from your parents, and it was a family full of hawks, basically. But somehow I became a dove on this day. And I remember going to school the next day, and it was all we could talk about. The nation was stunned. We were stunned. We were of an age with these kids that had been gunned down. And at the time, I couldn't have told you that this was about First Amendment rights, that this was about the usurpment of those rights, and that, and so much more. But as I grew and became a writer at some point, that has never left me. That day, that time, and that amazement of how this could happen in America. So that's really the genesis of my remembrance of the story. I knew nothing back then except that the National Guard had fired on these students and killed them.
How many of your other books are set in that same time period?
That's a good question. I write a lot about the 60s because I grew up in the 60s and it was my time. And, you know, when you're a kid, you're growing up in an environment that you understand as a child. And you are bombarded perhaps with lots of stimulation or sensory input or whatever it may be. But to parse that out and understand it later is the task of adulthood. And it may be the task of a lifetime. And it has sort of turned out to be that way for me as a writer, because I write about social justice issues, civil rights issues. I write about home, family, community, connection, kinship. Everything I write has, most of it has a good dose of humor in it as well. But it really digs into those topics from the 60s. That were so important to me as a kid that I didn't really understand and as an adult wanted to know more about. So the book Freedom Summer takes place in 1964 Mississippi, where I lived during that summertime because my parents were both from Mississippi. So we'd always go back every summer and right up into Kent State. I mean, I've written three novels of the 1960s for young readers. We call them documentary novels full of primary source material. And they are really what led me into Kent State. When I got to the end of the series, I did Countdown 1962, Revolution 1964, and Anthem 1969. And I kept bumping up against Kent State. And I said, oh, there's just no way I'm going to ever be able to write about it. It was too horrible. And then I found that there was no way I couldn't. Mm.
And from the end of the book, were you talking a little bit about you and why Kent State mattered so much to you? And how you researched it. There's this whole section at the end of the book about that and how people can find out more and learn more. Did you? It seemed like you spent many, many years on this.
It was research is a patchwork. And I sold the 60s trilogy in 2008 to Scholastic Press. And Freedom Summer had been a Simon & Schuster book. And then I had done three books that take place in the 60s, but they're timeless. They don't ever really mention the 60s, but there are no technological, like cell phones, computers, that sort of thing. And it's really my Mississippi childhood. And they also deal with some civil rights issues. And Harcourt published those. And then I moved over to Scholastic. They took a big risk with these 60s trilogy books to be able to budget for permissions for photographs, song lyrics, all kinds of ephemera, primary source material. All this time, though, there were little bits of Kent State coming to me. So I keep a lot of my research on Pinterest. And I know that teachers will use these books, and I know that just curious readers can delve into more that way. So when I find websites and different kinds of, you know, speeches, photographs, whatever they may be, I create a board for each book. And so Kent State had a board going already, but not as a way for me to think about I'm going to write this, just that, oh my gosh, I remember this. Let me save this. So by the time I decided to write about it, I had several years of research under my belt, but I still had a ton more to do, which is what I detail in the back of the book, which you mention is going to Kent State several times, sitting in that archive, the May 4th collection, wandering and sitting at the places where those students fell, going to the all-night vigil, going to the annual commemoration, visiting the visitor center, and just interviewing so many people that were wounded or there or in the town at that time, because you want a well-rounded story and you want to be able to include all voices.
So tell us a little bit about how you structured this to be this book to include all voices.
Well, I had a mountain of material. It was just so much material. It's amazing what you find when you do. I like research a lot, and I can get stuck in there, and I have to at some point begin to sift through enough to find a thread. And what is this story going to be? And I had no idea how to write about Allison, Jeff, Sandy, and Bill, the four students who died. And I certainly wasn't there. But what I discovered as I researched and was at Kent State and going through their primary source documents was that there were so many different facets to the story. How could I choose just one? So I talked with my editor, who's David Levithan at Scholastic, and I said, I don't know quite, I'm having trouble finding purchase for the story, how to tell it, even how to open it. And we talked about different methods, different ways, different ideas, and we discovered that we had both just read Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, and we had both just loved it. And I really loved the idea of these disembodied voices in that book who are talking back and forth to one another and having a conversation and in the cemetery overnight. And in this conversation, you get all the reader gathers all this information about the Civil War, about Lincoln, about the time period and time periods before that. Because some of those disembodied voices have been hanging around this cemetery for a long, long time. And I got to thinking that what if we did that? What if we had a conversation? What if they argue? What if they have different points of view? And it became so clear to me that we're so polarized now as a nation. And we're doing that thing where we're arguing back and forth and taking, you know, drawing our lines in sand and not willing to listen to one another and yelling over each other. And I thought that's exactly what was going on in 1970. We are not so different today than we were in 1970. So the idea of the conversation was born. And that's when David brought up the idea of collective memory. Any event in history is a collection of stories. It's a collection of memories. And we save those memories when we write our history. And that history is written, as we know, in so many different opinionated ways. It depends on who's telling the story. So if we were to collect as many threads of the story as possible, we would have a whole. So with those two things in mind, I went to work.
You know, there's two reasons why I said at the beginning of this that this is a very timely topic. One of them is that it is the 50th anniversary, just past the 50th anniversary of what happened at Kent State. And it was, like you said, May 4th, which has always been kind of a significant day for me for other reasons. I am named after my grandmother, Monica. And she was named after Saint Monica because she was born on May 4th, which was at that time the feast day of Saint Monica. Mm. And Saint Monica was the mother of Saint Augustine. And she is known for being very patient and, what would you say, kind of praying her son out of a life of kind of bad behavior to become one of the leading founders of the church. So May 4th always resonates with me for that reason. But the other reason this is very timely is because I woke up this morning, looked on Twitter, and saw something about the president making threats about shooting, having the National Guard shoot the protesters in Minneapolis.
Yep.
So, have we made any progress in 50 years?
Well, of course we have. We've made progress. We also just have a really long way to go in America. And, you know, sometimes I look at the arc of history and it looks like two steps forward, one step back. And, of course, life is like that as well. But we happen to be living in a time right now. Again, the word that keeps coming to me is polarized. But there's this phenomenon of government overreach that is dangerous, and we can see it, and I draw it in Kent State, that line from the beginning of our nation, even before that with the Boston Massacre, through Wounded Knee, through, and Kent State takes its place in that same place, and we can even look forward from Kent State into, and backwards to forwards, you know, from slavery to mass incarceration, from Kent State into the Dakota Access Pipeline, to separating families from our borders, school shootings. There are just so many moments in our history where we can look back at them and see where First Amendment rights were curtailed. A democracy operates as a government of the people, for the people, by the people. And we guarantee these rights to our citizens. And as police officers, we're sworn to uphold those rights of every citizen. And the First Amendment rights in this country give us the freedom to petition for redress, to protest what we consider to be unjust laws or institution, to say what we know to be true, freedom of speech, to print broadsheets or to investigate or to interview like we're doing right here, right now, you and me, you know,
right,
to be heard by our government. We have this program is one of those free speech moments that we are here together in. And when you squash that, you create the atmosphere you've got going on right now. When you squash that right to free speech, which is what happened at Kent State, what happened was that on April 30th, 1970, Richard Nixon, who was the president at the time, came on television to announce the incursion of Cambodia. He was widening the Vietnam War after saying he was bringing troops home. He began to widen the war and send our troops over the border from Vietnam into Cambodia to rout out the North Vietnamese, supposedly, and end the war more quickly. Students across the country and colleges everywhere began to protest because they knew that their number was up. The Vietnam draft had been, the lottery had been instituted in December, the previous December, and all of these college deferments were up for grabs. Nobody knew if they'd be still deferred to stay in college so they wouldn't have to go overseas and go fight in the jungle. So they began protesting. It was an unpopular war. Walter Cronkite had told us we couldn't win that war. And the country had been turning as well to more people who protested and more people who were against the war than for it. So these students were out en masse, and they were creating havoc in college campuses across the country, but nowhere but Ohio was the National Guard called out. Governor Jim Rhodes was up for re-election, or not a re-election, he was up for election to the Senate, and there was a runoff race that Tuesday, and he wanted to win, and this was a Friday. And over that weekend, when things got heated in town and those students who were in the bars were turned out of the bars and had nowhere else to go, and there was some violence and just broken windows and a trash can fire, and the mayor of Kent called the governor and said, send in the guard. He did. He wanted a show of force. And one thing led to another, which led to those troops occupying the campus. And it became more of a guard off campus as much as it was, we're against the war. You know, we're protesting. We get to protest. We're going to join the national student strike. And, you know, the guard had other things in mind. So
And not all of the students that were killed and injured were even protesting.
Two were just walking to class. Two who were killed were walking to class. One had just been to see his ROTC advisor and had made up his mind that he would join the Army, but he was going to hopefully be part of the psychological doctor kind of, you know, he didn't want to be so much involved in the fighting, but he knew that they would need somebody of his skills to be able to be with soldiers. Anyway, everybody had their own reasons for being there. Two were actually protesting and two were walking to class, but those bullets, those real bullets that white kids didn't believe were in those guns, were traveling 300, 400 feet to their targets.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Deborah Wiles, author of Kent State. Deborah, the book has been referred to, or the style of the book, as free verse. And it's in a, like you said, a number of different voices. How are they delineated in the book?
That's a good question, too. I've been calling it lineated prose. I'm not a poet. I don't think that I'm actually writing poetry here, but I do think that I purposely, deliberately lined out each line for its weight and how it would fall to your ear. And the way I made this conversation happen was by using the page creatively so that you have two students on the left, you have two townies and their voices on the right, you have a National Guardsman in the middle, and you also have a black student from Black United Students because they had a role to play, which I did not know until I started my research over there at Kent State. And I knew that voice needed to be in that book because it created part of the roundedness of the story. So there are oral histories from all of those people in Kent State. And I use, not verbatim necessarily, but I use those histories in order to create those voices. And so you know who's speaking, I'm using different typefaces and I'm using different sizes of fonts so that you can immediately know who's who, because they are disembodied. There is no name given to them. But the way that it flows day by day by day from May 1st to 2nd to 3rd to the shooting on May 4th, everything escalates. We also eulogize the students, and then we tell you exactly what happened to them.
I could see this being read as a play.
It can be. I thought of it more as a conversation and as a novel, but as I started putting it together and as it began to fall into place, because once you get the shape that it's trying to tell you it wants to be, once you get that shape, you begin to see it so much more clearly. And I said, this is like reader's theater. This is like,
right, exactly.
This could be staged either in a community or in a college or in a high school. It could be even in a classroom, given different voices. And so, yes, it lends itself. And also that makes me reminds me to tell you about the audiobook of Kent State. The book read is one thing, but if you listen to the audiobook, which Scholastic Audio has done, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. They were able to bring all six voices into the studio in New York in one day, and they read this around a table and performed it. And it's absolutely riveting, and it just really brings that prose to life. So I recommend both the book and the audiobook.
Now, in the book, are there illustrations and photos as well?
No, and that's another good question, because the 60s trilogy books are 400 and some pages each. And they are stuffed with, there's a novel about what's going on in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis with a family outside of Washington, D.C., which is where I lived at that time. My dad was chief of safety, so Franny's dad is the chief of safety and at Andrews Air Force Base. And then in 1964, we're in Mississippi with Freedom Summer and all those thousand students who came south to register black voters during an election year in Mississippi. And then in 1969, we're traveling from Charleston, where I lived in 69, in a school bus across the country to San Francisco, where we meet America in 1969, and lots about the Vietnam War, the counterculture, and rock and roll. So,
now, Deborah, this is beginning to sound a little bit like Forrest Gump.
It really was.
Like you were there, you were living in all the places where this history was happening.
Yes, I'm telling my story. And that's what we do as writers. We're always telling our stories, whether it's actually about us or not. It's emotional autobiography in a way. I did happen to have those settings because I had D.C., I had Mississippi, and I had Charleston. So, but the stories themselves are totally unlike anything that ever happened to me. They're totally fiction. But there are five different scrapbook sections within those novels that are full of photographs of the time that provide context. One of the things that I discovered as I spent 18 years on the road teaching in different schools and conferences and writers' workshops was that with young people, it's really hard for them to see themselves as part of a story, number one. And number two, it's really hard for them to understand history as more than dates, places, people, and events. So I wanted to give them the context to see that, for instance, when black voters are being registered in Mississippi and people are being arrested and jailed and it's really scary and we don't know what's going to happen to these characters and this family. At the same time, the Beatles are coming to America. This is in a scrapbook. At the same time, Willie Mays is having a great year in, with the Giants. And so there's a lot happening that's outside the purview of just that particular date, time, and event. So I wanted something to be able to offer fiction, nonfiction, and there are biographies in these books as well. And so I wanted, you know, this comes from, I don't know if you're familiar with the John Dos Passos USA trilogy. I had read those, and I was so taken with how those books chronicle the first three decades of the 1900s. And I was taken by the story itself, the camera eye, the newsreels that he puts in there. And I know that influenced me to create what's called, we're now calling a documentary novel. We had no idea what it was. It's just that I wanted to. I just said, I want you to see it, hear it, taste it, feel it, smell it. Will you do it? And Scholastic said yes. And I was just stunned and surprised and said, let's go. So we put these big, massive books together, and Kent State is the total opposite. To answer your question, my long way around, Kent State is quietly elegant and eloquent because it's so devastating that I don't want you, number one, I don't want you to be distracted by photographs, song lyrics. Well, there are some songs that start each section, but I don't want you distracted. I want you in it. I want you right there in it. And number two, there is so much about Kent State. All you have to do is write Kent State May 4th, and it comes up on Google, wherever whatever your search engine is. You just get a myriad of stuff. And I want you to go from this book to look on your own.
And of course, your Pinterest board for Kent State has a lot of that material too.
It does. Yeah, that's a good point. And I do have that for the 60s trilogy as well. But honestly, Kent State will give you the, there's a bibliography there, and there's all kinds of photographs, and there's songs. There's all kinds of stuff. There are two or three boards at Pinterest for Kent State.
How important was the music of the era?
Well, the music of the era was kind of everything. It starts an anthem for me when, like, 62 and 64, Countdown and Revolution, didn't have a whole lot of heavy rock and roll for me to access, although I do use music in everything I write. But with Anthem, Book 3 in 69, I had so much rock and roll to pick from that I knew at some point I was going to be writing Kent State, so I did not choose protest songs for Anthem. I just chose for each chapter, 47 of them, it opens with a song who the title, who wrote it, who performed it, and who the drummer was as well, because there's a drummer in the book. But that was hard to figure out, but that was great. That was great fun. I got to learn a lot about drummers. But by the time I got to Anthem, I decided to use that protest music. By the time I got to Kent State, I had put a Kent State still in the very last scrapbook of Anthem. So you are catapulting yourself from Anthem into Kent State. You don't have to have read one to have read another. They all stand alone. But with Kent State, I chose 7 different protest songs. And of course, the last one for May 4th is Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I played that record so many times until I warped it. It was so important to me. And it came out within months of the shooting, 4 Dead in Ohio. And
yeah, I certainly remember that. I was younger. I was only, 11 maybe when this happened. So it wasn't quite as much of a presence for me. But certainly Ohio, and then certainly War, What Is It Good For?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that one I used as well. And there's a song that anchors each one of the sections each day. And also the lament that begins the book, which I can read for you if you like at some point.
Yeah, actually, I was just about to ask you to read from the book. So if you want to read the beginning part of it for us.
I thought the beginning would be the easiest part because they're just 2 voices. And you can probably pick out those 2 voices. They're both students. The student that begins the book is basically our voice of reason. You know, here's what happened. We need an anchor. And then you have the hot-headed student who comes in behind him. And you can hear the difference in those. And I'll just read you the song that begins the lament is I Ain't Marching Anymore. Mm. And Phil Oakes. So here it is, Kent State, the lament. You are new here, and we don't want to scare you away. But we want you to know the truth. So we will start by telling you what is most important. They did not have to die. But they did die. They were sacrificial lambs, coldly, deliberately slaughtered. No, they weren't. It was a mistake, a tragic mistake. It was calculated, planned. They were lambs. It was a tragic mistake. You don't have the whole story, and you always think you do. I know what I know. I know what they did. I know that those kids will never wear tat sleeves or gauges or listen to Motley Crue or watch Star Wars or read Harry Potter or talk on a cell phone or use a computer or play video games or realize the Vietnam War is over and their unwilling, unknowing, unplanned for sacrifice helped it come to an end. Yes, it's a tragedy. And now there are other wars, more wars, war after war after war. War is never over. It's over if we want it to be. War is never over. John Lennon said it was. War is over if you want it. It's in a song he and Yoko wrote in 1971. Too late for Allison, Bill, Sandy, and Jeff to hear it. Are we going to argue again? Yes. We always argue when we speak of the killings. Let's try not to argue. Let's tell it the way we remember it, all of us. Because look, we have someone new here, someone new to listen to us. I see that. Hail, young friend. You are a feast for heart-sick eyes. I can tell you're about the same age that Allison was. Allison and her flowers are better than bullets. That's what she said to the National Guard soldiers the day before they killed her. I think our new friend looks like Bill. Bill was an Eagle Scout. Or Sandy. I loved Sandy. She was wearing a red sweater that day. Or maybe Jeffrey. Jeffrey went to Woodstock. And then on May 4th, 1970, less than a year later, he was shot through the mouth and killed instantly. I love Jeffrey so much. I love them all. I did too, of course.
9 were wounded. Don't forget them. I can't forget them. Or us. We were all wounded that day. Yes, yes, we all bear the scars of that day. Our country bears the scars of that day. We are forever heartsick. Yes, so let's tell the story one more time for our new friend. Let's try not to argue. I can try not to argue so long as you don't invite the others. The others will come. They always come when we remember. I tell them they are part of the story, even when they disagree with me. I disagree with you. We won't be able to stop them from coming. The ones who think those 4 deaths were justified. The ones who think more kids should have been shot. Killed. I hate them. There is no place for hate here. Not anymore. I hate them. The ones who want us to forget, they will come too. The ones who tried to erase the fact that grown-up America killed its children in 1970 and never apologized for it, I hate them. Tell the story, then. This is a place for remembrance and for sharing what we remember so it won't happen again. I'll stop there.
And that was Deborah Wiles reading from Kent State, and you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Now, this book just came out, and it's a little different than your other book launches.
It's different in that, you mean the pandemic?
Yes.
It's kind of different for all of us. Oh, my gosh. This
yes.
book is in, I've been publishing for 20 years, starting with Freedom Summer, which was a picture book years ago. And Kent State is the newest title. And this is the first book for which my publisher decided this was going to be one of their lead titles. And then we were going to have a national tour for this book. And we were just going to be out there in the biggest way because it was such an important story and so necessary to be told. And truth, in the back of this book, there's a huge call to action for young people. So I wanted to be out there with those young people and with their grown-ups, their adults, and telling them enough is enough, you know, let's change the world. And then 2 weeks before the tour started, boom.
No more tour.
I know, it was just, oh my gosh. And I have allowed myself to be sad about that. I've allowed myself to mourn the fact that there's nothing like being face to face with your readers and with the public and with booksellers who are so dear to me and hand sell books right and left for their audience to be in Ohio. I was going to be in Kent on May 4th and, you know, be there with my now friends I have made there over the years. And I mean, just traveling the country at festivals, conferences, libraries, bookstores, schools, none of which are available right now. I also have allowed myself, and it's impossible not to see the tragedy that we're living through right now and to see how difficult it is and how much we need one another and how we are finding our way to one another now in this COVID time. We're coming together state by state, sometimes community by community, and sometimes because we feel our national leadership is so scattered on this issue, just as it was in 1970. But we are doing it, much like college students came together to protest the Vietnam War after Nixon's announcement of the invasion of Cambodia. I mean, there are reasons that we do what we do, and we are communal people, and we are going to get through this. And it's the saddest, most, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what's happening. And yet it's happening. And so I think we're at a point now, it feels to me, with me in mind anyway, we've all gathered together to stay as close as possible. And we're in a new place now of, okay, we're in it now. And what do we need to do in order to take care of one another and others? So I just feel like I've been able to put it in perspective and understand that I don't really like the phrase "we're all in this together" because everybody's in it in a different way as well. You know what I mean? It's like some people
are pretending nothing's happening.
Yeah, that too. And that's a newer development. In the beginning, wasn't that way. In the beginning, it was more like, rally round the wagons, boys. And it was very different from, and again, this speaks to the polarized nature of our country right now, basically, and in our politics. So it's really a divisive time. And come November, it no matter what the outcome is in November, it's going to continue to be a divisive time because it's just gonna. And what is it we're going to do, you know, to change that? And in basically, we did rise up in 1970. The young people of my generation ended the Vietnam War. We raised the voting age the voting age to 18, because if you were going to be drafted, you should at least be able to vote. You know, we made noise and we understood that when you can't hear each other, you create an atmosphere of violence and fear. And we're looking at that right now again.
Well, one of the things that had puzzled me for a long time was as we moved forward and that generation became kind of the establishment, why things didn't change more in the establishment, because now these people who had been the hippies and the rebels had the power, except what I came to realize finally was that a huge portion of that generation never rebelled, never wanted the change. And they're the ones who mostly ended up in power later.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. That's mine as well, partly. This is very complex, and it's really a complicated issue. When I began to research for Anthem, and of course there's a big hippie population in Anthem, and that bus travels to the New Buffalo Commune in New Mexico, where everybody wants to change the world, and many other places along the way, including some very straight white bread places, including some Mississippi places that aren't so. And that book follows lots and lots of issues from the 1960s, but it's very clear that the hippie population wasn't as huge as we all think it was, and it wasn't as inclusive as we all think it was. And it was also extremely hard, which is why places like New Buffalo really don't exist anymore in the way that they had existed in the 60s, because it's really hard to create a life out of nothing and to be self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency is a direction. It's actually not the goal. You know, you're not going to be able to do that. But the peace, love, and free love and whatever, it's still there. I have it. It's still inculcated in those of us who grew up in that time and really, really believed that one person could change the world. I still believe one person can change the world, because the outgrowth of that is the next person, and the next people that change the world. But it's hard. It's a hard way to move forward when you aren't able to be inclusive. And part of my work is always about trying to figure out how people who aren't inclusive can become that way, or actually being able to speak to young people and say, hey, here's a path. Here's a path. And here's a path to peace. Here's a path to inclusivity. Here's a path to diversity. Here's a path to being able to work together, even if you disagree. Here's a path to being able to put people first. So, and then there's also just political and cultural things that happened through the years with administrations that were dismantling business, administrations that were giving all the power to business and corporations and making them people. And, you know, there is and always has been an element of greed and an element of me first. And we deal with that too. This is really kind of how people change and grow and develop and grow up. So I think our country has to do the same. It's painful.
It is. What are some of the things that give you hope, though? Like, for example, the kids from Parkland.
Oh, yeah, they're great. Yeah. And there are a lot of those. Greta is great and her climate change. And she's rallying people around her. And what I say in Kent State is it is the young who changed the world. We did, you know, we do our part, and you and I aren't done yet, you know. What we're doing right here is part of that, because you're offering up that path. You're offering up another way to look at things. You're offering up our history. You're offering up the history that can change ahead of us. So there's always a way for us to come together. And I see young people especially saying enough. I see it in the and you know what? It may be a gift of this pandemic as well, that there is a way for people to slow down. There is a way for people to do more with less. There is a way for people to realize what's important to them. And there is a way to make change. And it's a tragic way to have come to it. But it's also, you know, I wrote a book called Each Little Bird That Sings, where there's a Uncle Edisto says, open your arms to life and let it strut into your heart with all of its messy glory that you can't have up without down. Yes, without no, death without life. And life is lived in the opposites. So we've got a heck of a lot of opposites that we're looking at right now. And what do we choose to do with them?
I totally agree. We have the choice to come out of this better, stronger, particularly, you know, our economic structure seems like it is so fixed and so difficult to change, but it suddenly roared to a stop. Yeah. And so do we just restart it the same way it was, or do we look and say, oh, okay, things got torn down, we need to rebuild it, is there a better way?
It's like we have these voices that come into our every generation. I remember Steve Jobs and Apple, and here's to the odd ones and the creative ones. And I don't know that off the top of my head, but I mean, we have moments where we stop too. And this is one of those moments. It's like full stop. And we see who's essential, and we see how those essential workers aren't on the same level playing field as everyone else. And we see the dichotomies, and we see the inequities of the system that we've put into place, which has been put into place for a long, long, long time. I'm working on a book right now, the next book, which is about the lost cause of the Confederacy and the rise of white supremacy, because I'm a Southern girl and I want to understand what happened. And so doing so much research on that. And it shows me that this is this systematic leveling of people and classes and races has been in place forever. And how do we change that? We do have that opportunity now, but it's going to take us wanting to.
Right. And everybody can do a little bit, and all the little bits can add up to a lot.
That's what I think, too. And I think that your little bit, and that's one other thing that occurs to me as you say that, is the little bit does not have to be standing on that police line, but it can be. It doesn't have to be. I mean, here are the things. You can be a peaceful person. You can be a good parent. You can be who's always striving to be better. You can be somebody who wants to learn and is curious. You can be somebody who's writing about these issues. You can be someone who's on the radio talking to people about these issues and being able to get it out to that public that's able to do good work in the world. So I just feel like it's not. For me, and I don't think it's right to say you have to do it this way, but I do think that doing something is the important thing, whatever that something for you is.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Deborah Wiles, author of Kent State. Deborah, one thing I've seen recently on Twitter is people of privilege, which is mostly white people, committing to standing up as a witness when they see police officers interacting with people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Just being there witnessing.
Mm-hmm. And being able to do that is huge. It's huge. And it also, there's a whole reckoning going on right now. And I see it in children's books, particularly because that's the field I work in. We need diverse books. Black Lives Matter. the way that diversity is being addressed in children's books is amazing, and we need much, much, much more of it, not only in our books and stories that we tell, but in those who write them and in those who publish them. So we need that. And I think we're working toward that, and I think that it's a long road for various reasons. But I do feel like it has made me a better writer to have put myself into that space of, for instance, with Kent State, as soon as I found Black United Students, which was an organization at Kent, still is, but it was in 1970, and it was a pretty newly formed one then, I knew that I had an angle to that story that needed to be told. And over again in oral histories and in interviews I did, African-American students back then and who are adults now were saying to me, we knew there were bullets in those guns. You see a white man standing there with a rifle and you don't think there are bullets in those guns? Of course there were. We were told to stay away from the Commons on May 4th, and we did. When you talk about privilege, I don't even know if that's the right word here, but white students who were the ones on the Commons were all, they have blanks in those guns, or they don't have ammunition in those guns. They didn't believe that they would have bullets. And one of the things I heard over and over again in interviews is, I can't believe they shot those white kids.
You know? Yeah. And if it had been four black students who had died, would the outcry from the nation have been the same?
Well, you can see that 11 days later with Jackson State in Mississippi, where two students were killed by the police over an uprising on their campus. One was in high school and was visiting, and I think it was 9 or 11 others, 12 I think, were injured with a huge police blast. 40 or more policemen with guns were shooting into this crowd of young people because they had heard that there was unrest at the college, and they decided there was a shooter up on the other floor. But you know what? You don't see that. You don't see that as much as you do see Kent State. However, Kent State includes Jackson State every single year on May 4th at their commemoration of May 4th. They read the chronology of Kent State, but they also read the chronology of what happened at Jackson State. And starting year before last, they are now reading the chronology of what happened at South Carolina State in Orangeburg in 1968. So getting
to be... And I don't know anything about either of those.
Well,
or South Carolina.
The black student in Kent State says, I want to talk about Jackson State. I want to talk about Philip Lafayette Gibbs and James Earl Green and what happened to them. And I want you to go and look it up after you've read this and after you've heard this. Because we need to be able to bring those stories to the forefront as well. And we need, as white people too, to be able to be talking about that and to be able to be standing up. As you said, it takes all of us standing up, all of us. What would it be like for all of us, white people included, to be absolutely raising Cain right now about what's going on in our country and demanding change, demanding it, you know?
And instead you have huge numbers of people who thought it was wrong for football players to take a knee to protest police violence. That was so disturbing to me that people thought that that kind of protest was wrong or that should be illegal.
I remember in 1968, the Mexico City Olympics, when the medalists, the two black medalists, were raising their fists with a black glove on it, and how much pushback there was for that. And there's always going to be pushback, always. It doesn't matter even what color you are in that regard. I mean, there's always going to be pushback. Of course, if you're black, your pushback is a lot more dangerous. And that's why I think white people need to be standing up. So, and that's what I want to do with my fiction. That's what I try to do with everything I write. That's why there is that element in there of everything I write. And I want to be able to make a difference and to do my job. And basically, I want the books to be able to do their work in the world, which is why I so appreciate being able to come here and talk with you about it. And and highlight the books enough to get them out there so that they are in the hands that they belong in and can do their work.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Deborah. We're just about out of time. Mom normally has a quote at the end that we use, and I forgot to get something from her today. But let's see. Do you have a favorite quote that might work here?
Well, we can go back to Edwin Starr. War, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
And peace. To yeah. You so, and all your listeners.
Well, Deborah, as we're wrapping up, what are you working on now?
The Lost Cause of the Confederacy, the Lost Cause, right. And the Rise of White Supremacy, which will be a novel for young adults. It'll be a companion to Kent State in its way. I have no idea what I'm doing right now. Don't ask me.
But how long does each project take for
it
you?
It just depends. Kent State was a few years in the writing, much more than the teaching. I've had a book take a year, and I've had a book take 15, and even more. I have a picture book coming out about Rachel Carson, who was always a hero of mine, in September. And when that book comes out, that's going to be a Random House book. It will have been over 20 years that I've been trying to tell Rachel Carson's story. So books just take the time they're going to take, and they reveal themselves to you as they're ready.
Well, we didn't get a lot on your process, so just last little quick minute. Do you have like set hours that you work, or is it more free form for you?
It's different with each book. Some books really require you showing, I call it suit up and show up every day. and certainly with every single book, when I'm in the throes of the deadline space and revision, I'm there every single day for very long hours. My husband pries me out of the chair at the end of the day, and we go for a walk if I'm lucky. But I do have to take space of time, you know, where I'm not there every day sometimes. I feel like you're writing when you're not at the page. You're writing when you're in it, and walking the mountain or working in the garden or hanging with the kids or whatever it is, you know, your undermind is working. So there's not a set particular way that I work, but I work. I show up.
You suit up and show up.
Suit up and show up.
Well, thank you, Deborah. And we'll look forward to your future books. And I'm going to check out some of your past ones as well.
Well, Monica, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.